Hello again, ladies and gentlemen, moms and dads, boys and girls. This is the Great Beyond Podcast. I am Emery Lowe. Quick announcement for you. Because of the fact that my job has gotten busy enough to warrant the fact that this episode is late, I'm going to have to go and decide that for right now, instead of releasing an episode every week, I'm going to have to be releasing them bi-weekly, once every 2 weeks. So hopefully that doesn't bother you guys too much, and if it does, well, you exactly can't find me anyway, so it's kind of hard to complain to me. Anyway, as for the story this week, this story is Demonstration Day by Ian Creasy. He was born in 1969 and currently lives in Yorkshire, England. He began writing when rock and roll stardom failed to return his calls. So far, he has sold 30-odd short stories to various magazines and anthologies, and his spare time interests include hiking, gardening, and environmental conservation work. Anything that he says will get him outdoors and away from the computer screen. Some of his publication credits include four stories printed in Asimov's during the year 2006, of which one of them, Silence in Florence, is scheduled to be reprinted in Year's Best Science Fiction, Volume 12, edited by David G. Hartwell. As for the story, Demonstration Day has appeared in Ocean of the Minds in Fall 2003, and is shortly due to be reprinted in Van Heer Universe in February 2007. Wait, I got my timelines a little bit mixed up. It looks like it's already been reprinted, so it says February 2007. Man, I should really stop reading off these cards. Anyway, now to the story. Demonstration Day by Ian Creasy. Part 1. Roll up, roll up. Get your antimatter here. Gravitons, superstrings, Higgs bosons, all going cheap. Every proton has a lifetime guarantee. Buy caloric, ether, and nubilium while theories last. Special offer on orgon and vril. Dried ghosts, astrographs, universal meters, superconductors and Bose-Einstein condensates. Athenors and alembics, test tubes and Bunsen burners if anyone still uses them. I switched on Markor's domestic star, the spotlight, the stock. It had taken all afternoon to set up the booth, and I didn't want to have to take everything home again. As the scientists began walking in, I mentally assigned a sales target to each experimenter. Pale from lack of sun, or tanned scary colors from exposure to strange rays, the early arrivals stared at each other as if they'd forgotten what other people looked like. Their expressions told of the despair of failure, or the voyeuristic exhilaration of uncovering the universe's secrets. Only a few remained unmarked, as if they'd discovered an anti-aging drug, or been silently replaced by a robot they foolishly made in their own image. I recognized most of the arriving scientists, but one face was missing. "Any sign of Rankin?" said Andren, who'd been browsing my stock of entangled photons. "No," I said. "You think your device can find him?" He looked hurt. "You saw it at Demonstration Day last year. Given the right input, it can find anything. Grab one of those tables and I'll set it up." Let the sleuthing begin, I thought. Audrin had been nagging me to stalk his latest device ever since he invented it, and this would be a good test of whether it worked in the real world, as well as in carefully contrived demonstrations. "I need something close to him," he said, returning with his laptop computer. "That's the problem. All his personal stuff disappeared with him. Notebook, everything. But we do have this." I reached into one of my cases and brought out a dead dog and formaldehyde. He burst out laughing. "Is that the best you could do?" "Don't laugh. Occam here was his constant companion in the lab and acted as point man in his experiments, or point dog, you could say." "What experiments?" asked Audrin, curious. "No one knows, not even his daughter, only the dog, and he's not talking. Margaret reckons he died of a broken heart after Rankin disappeared, but I think lack of food and water might have had more to do with it. Anyway, she preserved old Occam in case her father wanted to do any tests when he returned, but he didn't come back. And so you called me. I still think a 10% royalty is pitifully low. You'll be getting 100% of nothing if this doesn't work. Do we have to take the body out and drain off the formaldehyde? I'd rather not." "We'll try it the easy way first." Audrin booted up the computer and plugged a homemade device into the back. "Got any Z-leads?" he asked. I passed him two from my stock. making a mental note to get them back after the test. Audrin clipped one end of each lead to his device and attached the other ends to the big specimen jar with sticky tape. "Wolf," said a passing scientist. "It's alive! Run! Run, I tell you!" I glared at him, and he sunk away. "The classical world is an illusion," said Audrin, looking at the screen and typing away. "The universe is a single quantum system in which everything is connected. Non-local entanglements." "Spare me the spiel," I said. "I heard it last year." He sniffed, annoyed at being cut off, but he shut up and typed for 5 minutes, without seeming to get much joy. Eventually, he said, "Can you open it up? No need to take anything out. We'll stick the leads in at the top." I didn't enjoy the task. I'm a salesman, not a vivisectionist. But after some ineffectual poking, we snagged 2 leads on the remaining patches of fur, and Audrin said that would have to do. Then he looked at the screen and shook his head. "Nothing. Are you sure it's his dog and not a stray?" That wasn't worth answering, so I didn't. Audrin shrugged. "I'm not getting a damn thing off it. If this dog ever had an odor, right now he's seriously unavailable. I've had livelier readings for corpses." "Looks like you need to improve performance before worrying about a brand name," I said. I recovered my leads and wiped them clean. "I've decided to call it the Quint," he said. "Snappy name. Shame it doesn't work." He looked devastated. "I don't understand what's wrong. Can we test something else?" "I haven't got anything else that belonged to Rankin," I lied. "And I can't stock equipment that only works when it feels like it. Come back to me when it's fixed." Audrin gave me a sour look. He picked up his kit and went upstairs to stow it away, safe from the prying hands of rival scientists. Paranoid? Yes. But I remembered the chap who invented anti-gravity. Someone got sick of him showing off, sabotaged his flying belt to stick at full power, and the inventor spent the rest of the convention glued to the ceiling. I put the lid back on the collie, who looked sadder than ever. The sharp taint of formaldehyde hung in the air, so I zapped it with an odor exploder, item number 16024 in my catalog. I left the specimen jar on the table. The chances of anyone wanting to buy an ill-preserved dead dog were low, but not zero. It might be just the thing for someone's latest research. And if Rankin became angry at me for selling his late pet, well, he'd have to come back to be annoyed, and that would be worth it. I was worried about him. I'd known him for years, and he'd never been so eccentric as to disappear without telling anyone. He was a friend, and he was one of my best customers. Calverly had been standing by my booth, watching the attempt to locate Rankin. He had a smirk on his face, presumably satisfaction at the failure of Audrin's Quint. There's a lot of competition among the inventors, and Calverly fancies himself as the top experimentalist. He likes to remind people that he's discovered 5 new principles, 8 strange particles, and 11 mysterious forces. He even wears a white coat to the convention, when most of the others make their annual attempt at dressing up and come along in suits that smell of mothballs and year-old sandwiches in the pockets. "Have you heard from Rankin?" he asked Vanzetti. Vanzetti, the president of the Advanced Studies Association, was looking by my bookshelf. "No one's seen or heard from him in months," he said. "It's very odd. Maybe he was abducted." He pulled down Kay's field guide to aliens of the nearer galaxies and began flickering through it. I knew he wouldn't buy it, so I gave the penniless theorist my best shopkeeper's glare. More likely, the government press-ganged him into weapons research in a secret lab somewhere. Calverly mimed a super blaster ray with the enthusiasm of an 8-year-old boy, pointing to the imaginary weapon at Audrin, who'd just come back. "Or maybe the Reds nabbed him," said Audrin. "They don't have much grasp of current affairs, these scientists." "Perhaps he's taken the chance to break into our labs and see what we're all up to," said Calverly. "I'd like to see him try," said Audrin. "I've got my lab so protected, it takes me 10 minutes to get in. If anyone tries, my Parazap throws them into the holding pit." He smiled and held Calverly's gaze. "I check the pit every week or so, or whenever it starts to smell." All this speculation seemed uninformed. I wondered if any of the speakers knew more than they were letting on. Rankin's daughter had hinted darkly at rivalries, saying he'd been worried that someone else was working on the same project. As more people arrived, conversation turned to scientific matters, the known, the unknown, and the dubious maps of the border in the Advanced Studies Journal. When acronyms and mathematics started outnumbering real words, I bought a round of drinks, hoping that this would bring the talk back down to my intellectual level. The scientists congregated in the bar, playfully spiking each other's drinks with lab alcohol, and Rankin's mysterious disappearance sparked recollections of the great experimental mishaps of old colleagues. "Remember Hogg?" said Vanzetti. "Clever fellow. Invented the practical angel trap. I remember the demo as if it were only last year. Never been so moved in my life. We all warned him of the consequences if he fiddled with the apparatus, but he just had to see what happened if he reversed the polarity. Next thing he knew, a swarm of demons carried him off to hell. That's no way for a scientist to go. Everyone shuddered. Calverly said. Then there was Caprivi. He built a dimensional traveler, and ended up proving that the higher spatial dimensions are tiny. He came back as a red smear about a nanometer thick. So Rankin might have suffered a laboratory accident, I said. It's possible, said Vanzetti, though he never struck me as being rash. He wasn't a tinkerer. This disparaging term drew frowns from Calverly, Audrin, and the other practical scientists. While the experimenters may bicker among themselves, they all gain up on the theorists. But there was no sign of an explosion in his lab, I said. It looked more as if he'd been kidnapped, then blown up. Calverly turned to me. He seemed rather keen on that interpretation. Is that the sign of a guilty conscience? What do you mean? I mean that if he had an accident in his lab, it could have been the result of rash experiments. Or faulty equipment. There's nothing wrong with my equipment, I said. There's the prices, for one thing, said Audrin. I ignored the price issue. It's an argument I can't win, and said, I only sell stuff that's been properly tested and vetted. That's why I refuse to stock your Quint when you couldn't get it to work. You can't possibly test all your stock, said Audrin. You don't know what half of it is for. Before I could answer that, Calverly said, I think you should tell us what equipment you sold to Rankin. Then we can test it and see if it's safe. Rankin asked me to keep his purchases confidential, just as you all do, I said. His project can't be that secret if he was planning to present it at demonstration day tomorrow, said Calverly. He might only want to demonstrate one aspect of his work. He could have several projects on the go. I looked around at all the gadgeteers and said, how many of you want me to abandon confidentiality and let everyone know what you're buying? There was a swell of protest, but Calverly shouted over it, Rankin's gone. What's wrong with a safety check? I laughed. That's the most pathetic attempt at spying I've ever seen. Are you really that desperate to find out what Rankin's been doing? I'd like to find out if he's been killed by your products, said Calverly. You want to believe that, don't you? Because if Rankin was killed by his own bad judgment, that makes you realize the same could happen to any of you. Whereas if he was killed by dangerous equipment, that doesn't reflect on him or on you, only on me. And you can be replaced, said Calverly. We can get our apparatuses elsewhere. But this is all supposition. There's no evidence that my supplies killed him. Except that you won't let us test because his purchases are confidential. At this impasse, we all looked at Vanzetti. This is why the president of the association is usually a theorist, someone neutral in these arguments. Vanzetti said, you're all assuming that Rankin's dead just because no one's seen him lately. But the demonstration isn't till tomorrow. There's still plenty of time for him to arrive. Let's not worry just yet. If he turns up in the morning, we'll feel silly for having this argument. The optimism sounded hollow, and I realized from everyone's expressions that if Rankin didn't show up, they would blame me. As the outsider, the only non-scientist at the convention, I was the easy scapegoat. They'd worry about the safety of my products, start buying elsewhere. Unless I could prove that Rankin's disappearance wasn't my fault. My business was in deep trouble. Saturday morning looked like an advert for washing powder. The fresh white snow outside was clean and bright as a new improved ultra detergent. Inside, however, an inferior rival brand had been used. There were drifts of papers everywhere, all covered with smudged equations, circuit diagrams, obscure notes, preprints of ASJ articles, and sketches of elaborate experiments. The tables were stacked with journals, books, notepads, and my equipment catalogs, all overlaid with scattered hats, scarves, umbrellas, and galoshes, not to mention miscellaneous toolkits, specimens, and devices. In the middle of the hall, three robots were constructing houses of cards. I recalled the drunken argument last night over whose robot had the most nimble, delicate manipulators. The robots had spent all night competing to build the highest structure, using punch cards from someone's old mainframe. Three slender, elegant towers rose high above the convention detritus. The oblong holes in the punch cards looked like windows in miniature skyscrapers. Metal Boy was winning. He was busy cutting a hole in the ceiling to make room for further ascent. I was the first real person out of bed. I don't drink, and I always get up early so that I can dispense Crabtree's hangover cum to the scientists staggering downstairs. The morning passed in a gentle drone of conversation and brunch. I sold some equipment and took orders and inquiries, but I wasn't as busy as I had been in previous years. After last night's safety smear, was my custom dropping off already? Rankin still hadn't shown up, and the long gaps between customers were making me edgy. I decided that I had to break my confidentiality rule. When Vanzetti appeared, red-eyed and bedraggled, he might be a theorist, but he'd been experimenting with cocktails last night. I gave him a double dose of Crabtree for instant sobriety. "What is it, Drake?" he said. "You know I don't buy apparatus. None of that dangerous mucking about with unknown forces for me." "I know. That's why I want to show you something." I turned on the impenetrable force field around my booth, giving us a private space. Then I uncapped a plastic tube containing a set of blueprints. I unrolled the largest print and weighted each corner with my latest novelty item, a plastic bubble containing a tiny castle on a crag. As Vanzetti picked up one up for a closer look, his touch sparked a lightning bolt onto the castle, and a roll of thunder followed by maniacal laughter. "For the scientist whose budget doesn't stretch to a real gothic mansion," I explained. I tactfully didn't mention that some budgets don't even stretch to lab equipment, which is one way theorists are born. Vanzetti laughed. "You never give up, do you? One day you'll buy something, even if it's only a piece of chalk, but never mind that. As I said last night, I keep all my orders in strict confidence. You know how paranoid people get about their work, but I think the circumstances call for an exception. Rankin still hasn't turned up, so he can hardly complain. As a theorist, you're not one of his direct rivals, so you're the best person I can think of to show this to. But I thought Rankin didn't leave any notes. Not in his lab, no, but he gave me the specs of the device he was building and disappeared 2 months after I delivered the equipment. This has got to be the key to the puzzle. What is it? What does it do?" Vanzetti looked at the print with a keen interest. I'd already looked at it a dozen times, so I watched him instead, hoping to spot a spark of comprehension, but his brow remained furrowed. "The only way to see what it does would be to build it, and I don't think even that would suffice. Most of this is just framework. He's left out the activating principle. I'm afraid I can't tell you any more than the obvious." "Which would be?" "Look," he said, pointing. "That's a seat. Why would he build a seat inside the apparatus? He'd only need to do it if it was intended to move in some way. It's a form of transport. But the engine details are missing from the diagram. So how it's powered and where it would go are anyone's guess." I felt stupid for not having realized this myself, but I'm used to feeling stupid around the scientists, so I didn't let it bother me. "What's your guess?" He shrugged. "There's a lot of possibilities." Then he smiled. "Maybe that's where he went. Possibilities. Lots of possibilities." I was puzzled for a second until I realized what he was driving at. "You mean parallel universes, where history took different paths?" "Could be. There's no evidence for it, other than the fact that he hasn't come back." "Why is that evidence?" "Think how many parallel universes there must be by now, billions of years after the Big Bang. Sideways navigation would be a nightmare. After leaving your home universe, how could you ever get back? Forget looking for a needle in a haystack. You'd have a better chance of finding a black cat in a black hole." Vanzetti must have seen my face drop. He said, "I was just speculating. It might not be that at all. It's a shame we won't find out what he is working on. I was looking forward to his demonstration." I remembered that, as president of the association, Vanzetti was in charge of demonstration day. "Didn't he tell you what he wanted to show?" He laughed at the thought. "No, they never do that. Surprises everything. It's the only way to make everyone's jaws drop off in admiration. If I had announced beforehand that I was going to turn lead into gold, for instance, one guy would say that he already made a mountain of gold and had suppressed the process because it would disrupt the economy. And another guy would say that it was an interesting advance, but not half so significant as his patent bootlace fastener." "Then how do you decide who gets the billing?" "If there's more than one applicant, I give it to whoever's waited longest since his last demonstration, or since joining the association. Rankin had years of seniority." I frowned. "But if Rankin doesn't turn up, does that mean you have to cancel a show?" "Oh, no," said Vanzetti. "Demonstration day is the highlight of the convention. Calverly was next in line. So I've said he can do it. He's already setting up, though he's got so much equipment that it's bound to be a frightful bore. I always say the best demonstrations need the least apparatus. Less is more, you know. In my younger days, experimenters poked that universe with a stick to see if it jumped, but now they can't even do that without buying your Cosmoprod 4000. He wagged a finger at me. "It's all your fault. You keep selling fancy equipment, so now everyone's building complicated machines with flashing lights and beeping gizmos. Big boys' toys, that's all they are. and there's no theory behind any of it. None of the new people in the association can integrate a spending function to save their lives. There are strange footnotes, the lot of them. While he rambled on, a big neon sign flashed in my skull. Calverly was Rankin's rival, possibly working on similar research. I had seen Calverly smirking when the Quint failed to find him, and Calverly had benefited from Rankin's disappearance by acquiring the coveted Demonstration Day lecture. Calverly was the number one suspect. No wonder he tried to deflect suspicion onto my equipment. I put Rankin's blueprints away, then de-energized the force field surrounding the booth. Vanzetti wandered off, still muttering about the mathematical inadequacies of the younger generation. I wondered how to approach Calverly, and a notion began to take shape. I was about to go look for him when he came through the door. "Calverly!" I shouted. "Ah, Drake," he said, hurrying across the hall. "Have you got any more of those monopoles?" I thought I might as well sail, and it was a good opening. "Sure," I said. "Today's special. With every 10 monopoles, a gremlin trap. See how smooth your experiments roam with when the little bastards are squeaking under a bell jar. I already have a gremlin trap." "Only one? How often is it out of action?" "Need another trap to stop on drinks in the first trap." "And a third to protect the second, no doubt," said Calverly, with a twitch of a smile. But he looked interested. I brought out my best trap and placed it in the middle of the table. I needed bait, so I began activating curious devices. A ball lightning generator sparked and hissed as it emitted glowing spheres of electricity, which floated around the hall until they grabbed themselves or fell into the domestic star like doomed comets. I set a universal Turing machine to grind out the decimal expansion of pi, and fed a stack of notes into my counterfeiter detector. Other scientists gathered around, attracted by the noise, and one or two added their own gadgets to the rapidly developing shrine of the machine. Soon there was a crunch as the Turing machine's tape jammed, followed by a faint cackle of glee, then a shriek as the trap sprung. "Look what we have here," I said. The gremlin was blue and about 5 inches high. One arm was a spanner set, and the other was a multi-screwdriver. Its wheels spanned furiously but gained no purchase on the frictionless floor of the trap. A Class 5 tooled up for action. "Kill it! Kill it!" shouted the scientists, their eyes full of hate at the sight of their ancient enemy. "It's back to entropy for you, pal," I said, opening the trap, but instead of squishing the gremlin, I flung it right into Calverly's face. He gibbered and sputtered as the gremlin reached up his nostril and started poking around in his brain. "Need more monopoles. Need more monopoles. The fossilization takes too much power." Then peeled out the gremlin off his nose and flung it to the floor. When it broke open, spilling tiny ratchets of lubricating oil onto the ground. A flock of inch-high Class 1 gremlins appeared and gathered up the remains of their comrade, then vanished, squeaking in grief. "What the hell was that for?" shouted Calverly. I avoided his gaze and concentrated on shutting down the other devices. "Sorry, I knew the gremlin would make you say the thing you most wanted to keep quiet. I thought if you had anything to do with Rankin's disappearance, it would come out then. Obviously, you're innocent, and I apologize." Calverly's face was flushed with orange. "You nearly made me give away my demonstration." And indeed, the other scientists were already whispering to each other, wondering what fossilization meant, and saying it didn't sound very exciting. "Sorry," I said again, while under the table my hand closed on a titanium strut in case he went for me. "I was concerned about Rankin." "You should be more concerned about yourself," said Calverly, still seething. "Selling overpriced, dodgy equipment is bad enough, but assaulting the customers is going too far. I want you out of this convention. At tomorrow's AGM, I'm going to propose that you are barred from all association events. Forever." "So you don't want to buy my overpriced, dodgy monopoles?" I wasn't going to let him show how much his threat worried me. He frowned, clearly needing the monopoles, but hating to back down. Concerned for his demonstration went out. "Yes, I'll buy them. If they're up to scratch. But it'll be the last sale you ever make." I bagged the poles and took his cash. I dearly wanted to jack up the price, but other scientists were watching the scene, and I knew I couldn't afford to alienate anyone by blatant profiteering. Tomorrow, I need all the votes I can get. And now is the time to start campaigning, by advertising my unique wares. Gremlin traps. Special offer on gremlin traps. All sizes up to Class 9. Come on, chaps, buy gremlin traps. Business was brisk. I was pleased, until I realized people were buying because they thought I wouldn't be around for much longer. We'll be right back. before I read the legal at the end of this episode, I'd just like to give a thanks to Russell Burke over at Comic and Whisper, the Action Centers, R.L. Burke, blogspot.com. On a podcast, the Playboy promo group from the Bob and Kim show. And I've seen the numbers go down, and I just have to give a thanks to Russell Burke for helping me cover his audience. Great Beyond Podcast Foundation, the Creative Commons Attribution, No Commercial, No Derivatives, 3.0 license. If you have any of the ways to but you can't change it, you can't sell it. The theme song, That Chain Sound, is used with permission of Beatnik Turtle. You can find their stuff at www.thesongoftoday.com. The last couple songs have done the last, the summer did the last time, 2 days ago. The Battle of Bloodborne is very extremely wonderful. I can say Ryan Wallachar has wonderful recitals. This is Emery Love for the Great Beyond Podcast. Stay tuned in 2 weeks for the conclusion of Demonstration by Lightning Crisis. This is Emery Love, signing up for the Great Beyond, The Void.